Welcome to Greatness, where the world's leading thinkers share their ideas about how to create greatness, great leaders, great teams, and great organizations. Why be good when you can be great? This is Gretchen Gagel, and I am so excited today to welcome Dr. Simon Longstaff to the Greatness Podcast. Welcome, Dr. Longstaff.
Thank you very much for having me.
You know, I ran across you. I'm sitting here trying to think back. It was, oh my gosh, at least several months ago, if not over a year ago. And I heard you speak, I believe, at an AICD event. And that's where I first became familiar with your work at the Ethics Center. And as we were just discussing prior to the podcast, I teach ethics at the University of Denver. And so always intrigued by work that people are doing in this area. Before we dive into your work, how did you become interested in ethics? How did your journey bring you to this point?
It's very hard to know precisely where the interest started. I think there was a personal event where my mother had died when I was 7 years old, which I think probably got me thinking about the nature of the world and question of how things happen and justice and a whole lot of other things. And that led then to a more general interest in philosophy. And then of those areas in philosophy, I suppose the one which is most strongly aligned to my inclination to follow in the footsteps of someone like Socrates, which is to work in the marketplace rather than in academia per se. That was the area of ethics, where you're dealing with the day-to-day choices that people make and the implications they have for the nature of the world in which we live.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. It's so interesting to me how we arrive. I'm very sorry for your loss of your mother. Well, it must have been a very difficult time, but it's interesting how those difficult times and those defining moments in our lives guide us in different directions and different thinking. So how did the early part of your journey into ethics evolve?
Because of a range of different family factors, I finished school when I was 16. So, and I then was told by my family that they'd invested all they were going to invest in me through allowing me to go to a boarding school, and I'd been well educated by that time. But it meant that I had to leave and take up work in order to secure funds enough to go to university, which is what I'd hoped to do. So a couple of days after my 17th birthday, I found myself employed on a very remote island in the Gulf of Carpentaria in the far north of Australia as a service attendant, which is just a glorified title for a cleaner. And all sorts of amazing things happened. I have then sort of evolved from that role as cleaner into becoming a kind of a safety officer working in the safety department, which effectively meant in that environment I was emergency services, you know, driving the ambulance and the fire trucks, trained as a paramedic basically. And so encountering injury and in at least one case death as a hands-on experience, which is very formative. I was then taken in and looked after by the local Indigenous people, the Anadliaqua people who are on that island, on Groot Island, and I still have kinship ties to that community all these years later. Now, I mention all of that because the thing that I think was one of the most instructive experiences in my life was being taken to the end of a jetty in the township of Aliangoola by the local Aboriginal people, a group of them, to show me how to see dolphins. You might think that's a strange thing to have to learn how to do. Surely you just look in the water and if there's a dolphin there that you'll see it. But they took me out and they said, well, can you see the dolphins? And I looked down, I couldn't see any dolphins. And they persisted with this question until eventually they said, we know what's going on. You're trying to see the dolphins in the water, which I thought was what I was supposed to be doing. And they explained to me that I needed to learn to see in a different way. And instead of looking for discrete objects, namely a dolphin in the water or a lamp on the table or things like that, the proper way to see, they said, was to look and recognize patterns. In other words, there's a particular pattern that's made by a dolphin when it's in the water, and there's another pattern made when it's not there, and the same can be true of the land and all sorts of things. And so I carried with me from that point onwards into my academic work in universities and then later my professional work, this lesson, which had been deeply embedded in me, about seeing the world not as discrete elements, but instead in terms of patterns. And in fact, that's been a remarkable benefit to me, because the nature of the work I do, which is very unusual, ranges all the way from end-of-life decisions in hospitals through to issues arising in war and everything in between, sport, corporations, not just in Australia but overseas. And the thing that more than anything else has aided me philosophically has been the ability to recognize patterns and to make sense of the world by using them.
That's a fascinating story. I'm reminded of one of my professors in my PhD. By the way, you secured your PhD from Cambridge, so you've obviously done a wonderful job through the years of supporting yourself in your pursuit of education. One of my professors was from South Africa, and she talked to us about soft eyes. And it was kind of the same thing, that you had to, you know, get soft eyes to be able to see animals. And but she wasn't just talking about, you know, it was very metaphorically like how you see things in a different way. That's really fascinating. And why is it so important for us to be talking about ethics today? Why do you feel so passionately about it?
Because if you understand it in its historical sense, not as something which often people hear the word and they think it's about compliance or just about, you know, forming judgments about individuals and their conduct. But instead, if you go back in both the Eastern and Western traditions and understand that it's seeking to deal with the architecture of human choice and that all that flows from those choices in the world, then if you can learn to make sense of what gives rise to choice and what freedoms we have or don't have and a whole range of ancillary questions, then you can begin to make sense of the world. I mean, my view is that the most powerful force on this planet is human choice, and that if you understand how it works, which is what ethics is trying to do by going in the Western tradition to that core question that Socrates poses, what ought one to do? And you understand that there are some axioms in that and that there are ways of thinking through the choices we make and therefore the world which is produced, that should be incredibly exciting, and especially so at this time when we're on the cusp of such extraordinary change. I mean, new technologies which will radically redefine notions like work or what it means to be human, or because of the integration of AI and robotics and then synthetic biology, or new geopolitical realities. All of these things are going to require us to make these very profound choices. And if we can equip ourselves to do so, it will be vitally important, but also incredibly interesting. So I see ethics as being absolutely core to the period of time in which we find ourselves. There's no room for unthinking custom and practice and the peculiar kind of blindness that brings on. We need to be engaged. And I think if we could just bring ourselves to embrace that possibility, even though it's going to be difficult, then the world will be so much better for having done so.
It's so interesting. I'm just wrapping up a 10-week quarter in leadership and ethics at the University of Denver. And one of my students, this is an MBA program. I would say he's probably in his early 40s, late 30s, perhaps. And he looked at me in class the other day and he said, when did you start thinking about all of this? He said, you know, I think it's ridiculous that I haven't been having this dialogue in my head that you're talking about. And I said, well, the good news is that you're having it now. And I feel very fortunate. The reason I teach ethics in this program is that I was part of the first MBA program that they had a full course in ethics in 1992. And in fact, Bui Sewell, who was my ethics professor, I interviewed him for this ethics course. I feel like it was an incredible gift to have that full semester course in ethics back when in 1992, it wasn't so normal to be having that. How can we create more dialogue around ethics?
Well, I think by beginning with issues that matter to people in their ordinary lives. I mean, too often people think that ethics is about things like, for example, the destructive use of embryos for stem cell research, or whether the death penalty should be there, or a whole lot of very, very serious issues, which makes people think, well, it can't be for me. But in fact, you know, when you walk into a supermarket and you ask yourself, what kind of eggs will I buy? Will I buy eggs from free-range chickens or those from caged birds? If you stop and ask yourself that question, then you are doing ethics. And then you can realise that just as it matters in what seems to be a very minor, ordinary or everyday moment, you can expand that out to some of the larger questions. In fact, every aspect of your life you can reflect on in terms of whether or not the things you are doing are consistent with what you understand to be your core values and principles. So I think, first of all, you know, let us see that it's down to earth. Second, that it's actually requires not perfection, because that can put people off too, but just that you actually approach the question with a degree of sincerity and skill. And if you do that and you get a sense of its practicality as well as its possibility, then I think people will embrace it and come to see that this is actually an enjoyable thing to think about, even if it can occasionally frustrate you by refusing to provide the single black and white answer that you might otherwise hope for.
Yeah, that is the interesting part. We have, when I redesigned this course 2 years ago, I added a question that the students have to write a response to in their asynchronous work. And it's a scenario that happened to myself and my husband where you're in a restaurant. We were brought the bill for our meal and it was an anniversary celebration and our bottle of wine had been left off of the bill. And I called the waiter over and said, "Hey, you know, you left our bottle of wine off." And he's like, "Oh my gosh, thank you for it." It was his reaction that was so shocking to me because he was shocked that we had told him. This was in the United States prior to moving to Australia. And I thought, well, why is that shocking to you? You know, doesn't everybody flag the waiter over and tell you that the bottle of wine? So in this instance, they're asked to write what their response would be in this situation. And it's fascinating to see what people go through in their minds of thinking about something this simple, what seems simple to me, right? Probably. And then when you put the pressure of bonuses and titles and shareholder return and everything, you know, we wonder why unethical behavior happens, but it's just very interesting to see their responses to what I feel is a simple question.
Well, I think what you've just pointed out there is a very important insight too. I think too often people think about ethics as if it is the isolated individual being solely responsible for the choices they make. No, we are ultimately responsible for the choices we make. But the context within which we do so and the institutional design around us, the way things work, they are very important. So the way that a business, for example, structures its incentive and reward mechanisms sends very powerful signals into the organization about what really is important. And you can have leaders of organizations who will profess with complete sincerity a set of deeply held beliefs about what the organization stands for, its core values and its principles and its defining purpose. And yet they'll simultaneously preside over a series of systems, policies and structures which send altogether a different message about what is really important. And people in these organizations will look at that and they'll say, well, what do you really believe in? What are you a hypocrite or are you ignorant? And, of course, people in leadership positions are often undone by their failure to understand the significance of that contextual set of arrangements. And it goes to the point that you're asking about in that story you told. I mean, what was the context within which the waiter was so surprised to find the absence of the bottle on the bill being identified? And what do people make of the context in a public company with the expectations of shareholders or management or their colleagues and how the place has been set up in terms of what it does in terms of their ethical decision making?
And that's the point. The point we drive home is, what's the process that you use to make the decisions? That and it's so interesting. I was very fortunate early in my career, a company I was with from 94 to 2005. The former president and chairman continues to be my mentor today. I learned a great deal from him about ethics and how you lead in an ethical way, in a visibly ethical way. he wrote a check back to one of our clients one time that we had done exactly. It was an investment banking and a strategy firm, and we had sold this person's company. We had done exactly what was asked of us. It was a transaction. So, you know, the transaction happened. Mm. The fee had been decided ahead of time. The client called us and said, I don't feel like that's a fair fee after the fact. And this person said to him, well, what do you think would be a fair fee? And he said that, and he said, great, I'm going to cut you a check. And he not only wrote the check and the letter back to the client about, you know, value, and but he copied every single employee in our company on the letter, and to send that strong signal about what we stood for, yeah, as a company, in our context of our business.
I think that's really important. In fact, in the work we do, which we do quite a lot of diagnostic work, for example, where we'll look inside below, if you like, the level of culture at the underlying elements that, from which cultures grow. And often you have people who say, can you just tell us whether we're as good as the person down the road? You know, can you do a comparison? We say, no, we won't do that, because the real test is not whether you're like someone else. The real test of ethics is whether or not you are like who you claim to be. And, of course, the example you just gave, which is an affirmation of the values and principles of the company that you were working with, is very powerful, because it says we really are who we say we are, and we do what we say we do. And, of course, those are the hallmarks of integrity.
It's interesting. So I was reading the report that came out recently, which is phenomenal, by the way. I plan to include a portion of it in my future courses, because you did a report with Deloitte, The Ethical Advantage. Tell us a little bit about the findings of this report. I find it fascinating.
Well, I think I should start with the question. The question we asked Deloitte Access Economics, and for those who don't know them, they're, I'd say, Australia's leading economics analysis firm. The question we posed was, to what extent, if any, does ethics contribute to the economy? And we were open to the possibility it might have not much of an effect, or a negative effect, or we just didn't know, and I don't think they did too. And so they looked at developing a methodology which drew upon 75 different data sets and 3 different forms of economic modelling to get as rigorously accurate an answer as possible. And they looked at the effects, and they were as extraordinary as they are surprising. So at the level of the individual, there's a clear correlation, probably even strong enough to say a causal effect, between the quality of ethics in a society and what we call ethical infrastructure, how well that's working, and general levels of prosperity. So if you were to increase the ethics of a society by, say, 10%, so you don't have to be perfect, as we were saying before, just better, you can improve measures of well-being for individuals in the tune of a percent or so, which cashes out to quite big numbers of improvements in mental health, physical health, employability, and things of that kind. At the level of the firm, the company, I think there's a 7% increase in profitability which is generated. And it's not magic. It's to do with the effects of ethics and trust and then economic costs. But I think the biggest number, which really stood out, was that a 10% increase in ethics can generate a $45 billion increase in GDP. And, of course, the thing that's chilling to realise is that a reduction by 10% takes that amount away. All those good things that I've just described are lost and reversed if there's a decline in ethics. Now, many people hearing me talk about this would be surprised in some ways. They say, well, why do you even need to quantify it in economic terms? Surely there are intrinsic reasons why one ought to do what is good or right. And I would agree with that. And in fact, I was worried about commissioning this research. But I also think that part of making an informed decision is knowing that those effects are available to you. The one thing that I think we'll have to try and communicate as this extraordinary work begins to be better known is that there's a paradox embedded in it. And it's a paradox which has been well known for many, many decades. And that is, Yes, there is a dividend from ethics, but if you do it for the dividend, you don't get the dividend. That's the paradox. You've got to find something which motivates you to act well, to, if you like, be true to who you are and what you say you do. Do it for that reason. And if you do, then you will secure the benefits, but don't do it just for that reason alone. That is the economic payoff.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. So what do we do? First of all, I'd love for you to share your website so that people who are interested in reading the study can find you and find the study.
Yeah, it's very simple. It's ethics.org.au. So if you're listening to this and just think Ethics Organisation Australia, you've basically got the website there.
Great, ethics.org.au. So I'm a listener out there. I'm a leader in an organization. I believe, you know, whether it's because of this report or whatever, that I want to take ethical decision making more seriously. What do we do? What's the do part to get these increases?
Well, the steps are pretty obvious and they're not particularly difficult, although they can be challenging. The first thing is work out what is the standard for judgment in your firm. So how does someone know that a decision they might make is a good decision or the right thing to do? And that means defining your core values and core principles. You need to tie them together with a connection to a defining purpose, and that will provide what is distinctive about, if you like, the DNA of your organization. Second thing you need to do is to measure the extent to which what you say is true or not. And that's not just a matter of doing a survey, say, to test employee engagement. It's also by having a forensic examination of systems, policies, and structures. So talking to your employees, your suppliers, your customers, and all the others, and just asking them, we say that we stand for this, do you find that to be true, is one thing. But that evidence needs to be correlated with, a forensic examination of what messages, what signals are being sent by those systems, policies, and structures. And then you start to close the gaps. And to do that, you need six things, which I'll briefly mention. You need some kind of commitment from the top so that the whole thing doesn't become unraveled by a change in leadership. So it needs to be something which is deeply held to be right and good to do. You need to be able to talk about the choices you're making using the language of ethics and not just reduce everything to a calculation of what is practically useful or aligned with strategy. You've got to talk about it in connection of values and principles. You've got to do that analysis I talked about before in terms of system, policy, and structure and bring it into alignment. You've got to have open communications where people are able to say, hang on, we say this, but we keep on doing that. And I just cannot reconcile that. And rather than this being seen as a courageous act or defined as an act of whistleblowing, it needs to be accepted and expected as a normal part of what a curious person would do working in that organisation. Next, you have to delegate authority. Too often we've had organisations which have sought to manage risk by creating a narrow system of compliance in which no one can choose to do anything wrong, without realizing that quite inadvertently they've created a world in which no one can choose to do anything right. And if you don't make choices, if all you're doing is complying, ticking the box, then the skill of ethical decision making is progressively lost. And finally, you've got to be prepared to take a longer term view, because there will be times when, by a practical commitment to your values and principles, you will choose not to do something, and that not doing it will cost you something, or you will act in a way that has a cost, much as the way your old boss did when cutting that check to return a fee that their client thought had been overcharged. So all of those things in together are practically going to generate the results, but it's having those elements in your toolkit and just progressively being open and honest and working towards getting the alignment, which is entirely capable of being measured if only you choose to look.
Wonderful, wonderful advice. And I deeply understand how you have risen and garnered the respect of people, not just here in Australia, but globally. The other thing I found fascinating when I was reading your background, Simon, was that you are the co-founder of the Festival of Dangerous Ideas. I had no idea. So tell us in we'll talk about that a little bit and close, you know, wrap up with some closing thoughts on ethics. But how did that come about, the Festival of Dangerous Ideas?
Well, it's partly a friend of mine called Richard Evans had moved from running the Australian Ballet to being the CEO at the Sydney Opera House. And he was wondering what might be done at the Opera House, this iconic building of global significance that went beyond simply the presentation of opera, ballet and theatre. And I'd been thinking about the very serious need to try and create a space within which it was possible to discuss difficult ideas, dangerous ideas. And that's because when we started 13 or 14, maybe 15 years ago, you could already see the early signs of a clamping down by those who sought to insist upon ideological purity, this kind of crystalline purity, whether it was of the left or the right or something in between. And my view is that the way that you maintain an open space, a civil space for society to discuss its issues, that happens only if somebody's prepared to push the boundaries in order to keep the middle clear. And so Richard and I decided to co-found this festival, the Festival of Dangerous Ideas, where it would provide a safe place for people to come to encounter things which would challenge all the things they believed in, even though it might seem perfectly obvious to the person proposing the idea. And having encountered that, they don't have to accept it, they don't have to change, all they would need to do is listen. And it's been a tremendously exciting thing to do, although always on the edge of controversy, which not everybody likes, but I think it's been a good piece of service to our society.
Yeah, I think, gosh, I've spent so much time talking about this, our ability to have civil dialogue, to disagree, to be open to the fact that we might not be right, that our thinking to be challenged, that's so amazing. The Sydney Opera House holds a very special place in my heart. I was raised in Kansas. My Australian mm-hmm. husband loves to tell people I'm from Kansas. He thinks that's the strangest place I could possibly be from. And I came into a little bit of money when I was 12, and my mother said, "What would you like to do?" And I said, "I'd like to go to Australia." And so in 1976, I visited the Sydney Opera House for the first time. And what a transformative experience that was for a young girl to visit New Zealand and Australia back then. So
what made you choose that to do with the little bit of money?
Who knows? Who knows? People ask me that and it's like, I don't know. It just seemed like the most exotic place I could think of, the most faraway place to go. And my mother, brought me here, the two of us. And it was a very fun experience.
Oh, it's a great thing that you two were able to do.
Yes, yes. She's no longer with us. She inspired my love of travel. She missed meeting my Australian husband by 5 months. But I know that she is somewhere looking down on me thinking, oh my gosh, she actually lives in Australia now. So it's been really wonderful to have this conversation. Any parting advice for our listeners? Obviously, the depth of your thinking, and I feel like we've just barely scratched the surface of your thinking around ethical decision-making and ethical infrastructure and, everything that you spend time doing.
I'd leave you with three thoughts. One is to think about the importance of rediscovering a discussion about the purpose of things. And here I'm not talking about purpose statements which are seeking to inspire, but the actual reason why we have things like markets or corporations or universities. And as a clue to this, there's an old Greek syllogism which is something like this. What is the purpose of a knife? The purpose of a knife is to cut. What then is a good knife? A good knife is a knife that cuts well. Well, you ask the same kind of thing. What is the purpose of a market or a corporation? And then that helps us to tell whether we have a good or not a good version of that. And this seems to me very important because I think we have to rediscover the purpose of things. Too often they've been portrayed because we've forgotten about the underlying purpose for which they were established. The second thought I'd leave is that we should be generous with ourselves and not expect too much, that ethical perfection, for reasons I won't go into now, is philosophically impossible. And therefore, once you realise that, rather than being frustrated by that knowledge, it should liberate you to some extent to accept that for yourself and others, we should not expect perfection, but simply that people are sincere in trying to do the best they can and that they develop the skills, which I know people like you try to teach them, so that they can do a better job of that. And that can be quite liberating. And the final thing is that even the apparently small decisions we make matter, and that heroic acts are not all those of great figures from history like Mandela and co, but there's something heroic just in falling on the right side of a question, just that little bit on the right side of it. And if enough people do that, then the world becomes a better place.
Mm. Wonderful parting advice. Thank you. I know you're an incredibly busy person. I really appreciate you taking the time to join us on the Greatness Podcast today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Interested in hearing more? Visit us at greatnessconsulting.com. Thank you.